From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Troy Oppie. Gemma Gaudette is off today. Happy Friday. It's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to be talking about the news that made headlines this week with our panel, Ian Mack Stevenson of the Idaho Statesman, Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, and from the Idaho Capital Sun, Kyle Fonensteel will join us as well. Hello, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. Kevin, I'd like to start with you. News yesterday that will affect Idaho schools. Senate Bill 1100, set to take effect next week, requires bathrooms and changing rooms in public schools to be limited to only males or females based on a person's sex assigned at birth. It's now blocked again. What's the latest there? I'm not sure if we have Kevin at this moment. Let's turn to elections. Ian, the Boise mayor's race is heating up. Multiple forums in recent weeks, some with all four candidates, some with three of the candidates. A television debate with just the front runners this week, incumbent Lauren McClain and challenger Mike Masterson. Ian, you've been following this closely. What are the main talking points now as the campaigns are coming down their stretch run?
Yeah, absolutely. So this November, as listeners may know, Mayor Lauren McClain, who's finishing up her first term in office, is facing a more conservative challenger to her right named Mike Masterson, who's a former police chief in Boise. They've had a number of debates in the past few days, in the past couple of weeks, talking about issues in the city. I would say that for the mayor, she's really running on her record of what she sees as her achievements related to affordable housing in the city. This is something that has been a concern for residents for years now, as we've seen, you know, rapidly rising rents, housing costs. And so she's running on her efforts over the past few years to partner with developers to build more affordable housing, and also the city's recent total overhaul of its zoning code, which changes the building rules for where homes can be built, how many units can be built, what kind of development we see along transit corridors. And her hope is that this overhaul, which is the first time in over 60 years that there have been these major codified changes to the law, that that'll bring more development and bring the cost of housing down as it brings in more units. For her opponent, Masterson, as I mentioned, he's a former police chief. And I think for him, that's the focus of his campaign. And I think is a lot of the reason he got involved in the race. He's been very critical of the mayor's management of the police department over the past few years. And how she's handled some issues that have come up with the department, for instance, with the former police chief Ryan Lee, and some lawsuits that have been filed against the city from former police department employees. And so I think the two of them have different focuses in this race, but I think a lot of it has to do with what we've seen over the last few years and what both candidates' vision for the future of the city is.
And with four candidates in the race, if no candidate gets 50%, it would need to go to a runoff, correct?
Yes, and that would then happen sometime in December.
Okay. Kevin is back with us now. So, Kevin, Senate Bill 1100 blocked by a court again. What's the latest with that?
Well, the latest development, Troy, is the law is now back on hold. A circuit court on Thursday put an injunction back in place. So what this basically means is that the law that was passed back in March, which would require schools to would require students to use restroom facilities, locker rooms, changing areas that align to their birth gender. Mm-hmm. That law is now on hold. So it's still going to work its way through the courts. This is going to be an ongoing legal battle.
And the Ninth Circuit is expected to take a couple of months to kind of sort this out and schedule hearings before that appeal is determined. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be my I don't know that for a fact, but I would imagine that this is going to be a long process, as it's been working through the federal courts at this level, at the state level.
The law was set to take effect once it was unblocked by a federal judge in Idaho. How have you been hearing that schools were preparing to comply with the new law?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, because the federal judge's ruling, Judge David Nye, a couple of weeks ago, basically he lifted the injunction and said that he wanted the law to go into effect within 3 weeks. That would have been next week. Mm-hmm. So schools were definitely on the clock, and now they're not. So this has been sort of an ongoing, developing, changing situation for schools and for students who are affected by this policy.
We're going to talk more about elections here with our guest, Ian. You've been covering some very, I would say, tight and important council races in the city of Boise. Districts 3 and 4 have several candidates in each one. There will be new faces to the city council. What is happening in those district races?
Yeah, so these are some pretty interesting races. For listeners, listeners may know that this is the first time that every city council race in the city is going to be by district. And those districts have been set geographically, and districts 3 and 4 are for people who live in the southern portions of Boise, as well as the bench area. So district 3 is if you live on the bench over down towards Overland Road and south towards Victory Road. And then district 4 is really large district, stretches all the way from southeast Boise near Micron over to the airport and almost up to Cole Road to the west. And District 3 especially has four candidates. Chris Blanchard, who's a planning and zoning commissioner. Kathy Corliss, who's the former head of a neighborhood association out there. Josh Johnston and Teresa Votter. So there are four different candidates. I think all of them would be, as you mentioned, new faces to elected office. And they held a debate recently and talked about a number of things. One was the Mercurio Park controversy, which happened a few years ago. This is a park area out in southwest Boise that's actually outside of the city limits that was planned as a park for a long time. A couple of years ago, the city was considering swapping it for land in the foothills, which angered a lot of residents in the area. And so now the candidates running for this city council office, since those plans have been shelved, a lot of them really want to see the park getting developed. And I think there was some interesting disagreement between candidates about how that might come forward. For instance, Chris Blanchard and Kathy Corliss seem pretty intent on developing that whole area, which is about 160 acres, as a park.
Which in your story, that's comparable to the size of Ann Morrison Park. That is no small park.
Right. That'd be a really large park. And one of the other candidates actually in the District 4 race, Jordan Morales, he pointed that out and said, you know, listen, this is Ann Morrison Park is a huge park that's surrounded by really dense neighborhoods downtown. And as a result, it gets a lot of use from the public. A park of that size out there, you know, that's maybe more of a challenge. And maybe we should look at developing part of it as a park and then having the rest of it be for other uses. So that was a big issue at the debate. Climate change and how the city should be addressing that was also a big topic. Josh Johnston, who's an engineer, he said he was pretty skeptical. He's a Republican candidate. These races are nonpartisan, but he mentioned that he's aligned with a political party. And he said that he's pretty skeptical of the city's electrification efforts regarding its vehicle fleet, buses and things like that, because he's worried about the overall effect that might have on the power grid. Whereas some other candidates like Teresa Votter and Kathy Corliss were pretty supportive of the city's clean energy goals of bringing the city to carbon zero. So I think that race in particular is really interesting to watch. I will say quickly that District 4, Jordan Morales is running and another candidate, Janet Burke. However, Janet Burke has not been participating in public forums. She also didn't respond to the Idaho Statesman's voter guide. So she wasn't at that debate a few days ago.
And these are for two different lengths of terms, correct, between the two districts, 3 and 4?
Yes. Some of the districts in the city are only for 2 years because the city wants to stagger the races in the future. So this year, District 3 is for 4 years. District 4 will be for 2 years.
Kyle, you've been reporting on this year's open enrollment. So this is Idahoans' time to purchase health care insurance on the state exchange or Medicare open enrollment happening now as well. And just for the sake of keeping everything clean, let's quickly break down the difference between those two things.
Yeah, so open enrollment is open for insurance plans right now. There's a few ways people can shop for insurance. Right now, the options for people to get insurance that offers tax credits to Idahoans based on their income is on Your Health Idaho. That's the state's health insurance exchange. And open enrollment is also open for Medicare, which is open for people age 65 plus.
I've seen Governor Brad Little doing a little flag waving for the state's health insurance exchange in recent days, the number of plans available that Idahoans have to choose from, and kind of the growth of this program since it began several years ago. How have things evolved now to where we are in 2023?
Right now, open enrollment is open for people in health and dental insurance plans for 2024 through Your Health Idaho. Open enrollment is a time every year when people can choose plans. It happens from October 15th to December 15th. And in recent years, Your Health Idaho has tried to make it easier for people to find out how quickly they can qualify for tax credits. Right now, they're saying that Idahoans can go online to yourhealthidaho.org to find out within minutes how much their tax credits would be, which could cover some or all of their monthly insurance premiums. And Idahoans can also expect to see savings on their health insurance this year. Your Health Idaho Executive Director Pat Kelly said in a news release last week that Idahoans will be surprised at just how affordable health insurance can be. Right now, they say that more than 88% of people enrolled on plans through Your Health Idaho get a tax credit, with about one in four receiving monthly premium-free insurance. Many Idahoans also qualify for cost-sharing reductions only available on silver plans, which offer extra savings.
State officials, though, have also issued a bit of a warning on the Medicare side. What are they telling consumers to be cautious about?
Yeah, so while it's also time to shop for Medicare plans, which are open for enrollment until December 7th, Idaho insurance regulators are warning people to be wary of improper marketing by telemarketers and TV commercials for Medicare. The Department of Insurance recently offered some advice for how to shop for Medicare plans. Here's some of their key tips. It recommends to contact licensed agents or the senior health insurance benefits advisors at 1-800-247-4422. Licensed agents can be found online through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. The department also says to hang up if callers you don't have an appointment with ask you for your private health or private information, like your Medicare number or financial information. They note that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, the federal agency that administers Medicaid, will not call you about Medicare coverage, and companies that sell Medicare Advantage plans, which are private plans, can't call to market rather than those offered by the federal government. Mm. The department also says, you know, be cautious of changing insurance based on ads on TV or in the mail. Those benefits might not be available locally. Request details in writing for a plan before signing up for a plan. Verify that your doctor is in network and your prescriptions are covered.
And once again, those deadlines for Medicare open enrollment, you said December 7th and a general open enrollment on the state healthcare exchange through December 15th, right?
Yep.
Very good. Kyle, I want to stick with you here because you reported this week on how state officials are also trying to increase the number of people who get food and nutrition benefits from the Women, Infants, and Children's Programs, known as WIC, because there's a big gap between the number of people in the state who qualify for those benefits and the number of people who are actually receiving them. Tell us about this.
So in short, the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, which provides free foods, health screenings, nutrition counseling, referrals to other services like food banks and rental assistance programs, it's serving less people than it can. Enrollment in the program is low across the nation, but even lower in Idaho. National estimates suggest that about half of people eligible across America are enrolled in the program, while about 4 in 10 eligible Idahoans are on the program. But officials administering WIC services in Idaho say they're working to boost low WIC enrollment by spreading the word online and at events. They're also working to understand more about why eligible Idahoans aren't on the program. So why aren't people eligible for WIC enrolling?
Mm-hmm.
Experts name a few reasons. Some people might not have the time or access to transportation to attend appointments for the program. Some people also might not want to access public assistance on the program. experts even named that some people fear they're taking away assistance from other people who need it more, which they say isn't the case. And what's especially important is some people might not know that they can earn more and still qualify for the program compared to other public assistance programs like SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, or Medicaid.
How much benefit does the average WIC recipient receive in the state of Idaho?
I believe it's about $64 of $84 of healthy foods per month. And to qualify for WIC, people must be pregnant, recently pregnant, breastfeeding, or have a child under five. Idaho's WIC guidelines say that, for instance, a family of four people could qualify if they earn up to $55,500 per year. A household of two could qualify if they earn $36,482 per year, or $702 a week. And WIC counts pregnant people or pregnant women as two people. Mm.
Kyle, thank you for your reporting on that. You can read that at IdahoCapitalSun.com. Kevin, attorneys for the State Board of Education and the State Attorney General's Office were before a judge this week. They're arguing the merits of the AG's lawsuit over the use of executive sessions by the Board of Education to deliberate on the purchase, University of Idaho's purchase of the University of Phoenix, the online remote learning school. Was there any movement on the lawsuit this week? What happened in court?
Well, there was no resolution, Troy, and really there's no good sense of when we will see a resolution. This lawsuit has been going on for 4 months, and it is an open meetings lawsuit at the heart of it. And I'm not trying to trivialize open meetings. We love open meetings. Mm-hmm. But this has really become much more of an existential fight over the University of Idaho's plan to purchase Phoenix. I mean, if Attorney General Labrador succeeds in court, and it's unclear how that's going to play out or if that's going to happen, it would effectively bring this purchase to a standstill. And there are a lot of things that still have to be resolved for this transaction to go through, mm-hmm. not just the lawsuit. I mean, accreditors for U of I and the University of Phoenix have to sign off on the deal. And then the nonprofit entity that U of I is putting together to engineer this purchase, they have to go out in the bond market and, you know, finance a $685 million deal. So there are a lot of uncertainties surrounding this deal. And the court hearing the case right now, I think, is as uncertain maybe as it was when we went into court Thursday afternoon. Heard arguments from attorneys on both sides. The judge made no decision about whether to proceed with the lawsuit or throw the lawsuit out. Theoretically, he could come back and throw out the lawsuit anytime he wants, or he could decide there are issues I do want to look at further and take this thing to trial. He said from the bench on Thursday afternoon, if this goes to trial, that would happen within 3 months of his decision. You know, this could go on for several more months. Hmm.
And they had originally anticipated being able to close this deal sometime early next year and then get to the bond issuance,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Early 2024. This case could still be in court in early 2024. So a lot of question marks right now surrounding this this very controversial purchase.
Well, and the crux of the argument seems to be that the state attorney general's office is arguing there's no way to know for sure that there was bidding competition. And that, yes, because bidding competition was used to justify the closed executive sessions, that's where the rub is. How is the state board trying to prove that they knew or they were aware of external bidders?
That's absolutely the crux of this lawsuit. It's the question of, was the U of I in a bidding war to obtain the University of Phoenix? What we do know is that there was another state that was looking at Phoenix. The University of Arkansas was looking at Phoenix. Their Board of Regents voted not to proceed with a deal in April, right in the middle of all these executive sessions. The Arkansas trustees voted to opt out of pursuing a Phoenix purchase. So the real question is, how did the state board determine that there was competition, and competition with other states or nations? That's a very important distinction in the open meetings law. It has to be competition with other public entities that you can use then as justification for having a closed meeting. Mm. Labrador's deputy argued on Thursday that really the state board didn't pursue, they didn't ask enough questions. They didn't really look into the question of competition. Trudy Fauser, the attorney that the state board has hired to defend the board, said it stands to reason that there was competition. It was reasonable to assume that there was competition because right now higher education is in this really competitive mode where a lot of universities are trying to figure out how to get more online options available to students, trying to figure out how to partner with online online education providers. So it stood to reason that there would be competition. But yeah, that is that's the big legal question right now.
All right, Ian, you took a very in-depth look this week at the aquifer under our feet in the Treasure Valley. That's our main source of residential drinking water, serves private wells as well. And there's a concern that as development spreads and conservation efforts lead to less water making its way from the surface back down to replenish the aquifer, that concern is present. But you reported that experts think the outlook isn't necessarily bleak.
Yeah, so we went into this story in part because looking across the West, the Mountain West in recent years, there have been a lot of water issues in a lot of states. So we wanted to take a look at what the situation was in the Treasure Valley. And what we found was that the situation here is a lot of the problems that we're facing with water, some of them actually are more about man-made influence than necessarily a specific natural resource issue. And what I mean by that is, as you mentioned, the groundwater has been declining. And the reason for that is that, at least in the Treasure Valley, for over 100 years, there's been pretty intensive agricultural irrigation. There are a lot of farms in the Treasure Valley. And when people settled here and built farms, they built lots of canals to spread the river water all over the valley and allow them to grow crops. And a lot of those canals are really, at least the old-fashioned ones, were really leaky, really inefficient. Farmers use something called a technique called flood irrigation, which is you basically just flood your entire field. And what that means is that a lot of the water that's either in the canal or in the going into the farm actually just seeps into the ground. And so it raised the aquifer level higher than it might have been naturally. And over the past few decades, if you look at, you know, people talk about this a lot, but there's been a lot of development of the Treasure Valley, of Boise expanding, Meridian expanding, CUNA expanding. And as those expansions have happened, previous farmland has turned into subdivisions, roads, highways, big box stores, you name it. And one of the sort of knock-on side effects of that has been potentially that there's less water being pumped into the aquifer because there's less irrigated land, and that that's causing the aquifer to decline, and that that's causing a problem for wells and for people who have private wells out in the Southwest Ada County area. So it's not necessarily a huge change in the amount of water that's coming in. It's just sort of a different use of it by humans who live in the area.
And what gives the experts that you talk to some stability in their forecast that we're not drawing this aquifer down too fast?
So I think one of the things is that while the what they call the shallow aquifer has been declining, they don't necessarily think that there's a big problem with the main aquifer, the Treasure Valley aquifer. Apparently, as I've learned from water experts, it's a pretty complicated aquifer. There are multiple layers in different places. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the private wells that have been having trouble in Southwest Ada County, those wells are only 50, 60, 70, 80 feet deep. And so they're pumping water from what's called the shallow aquifer. And so while some of them are starting to have trouble, the really deep wells that, for instance, Veolia, the largest water provider in Boise, use, their wells are several hundred feet deep. Much deeper than these shorter private wells. That lower aquifer, these water experts tell me, is not having a big problem so far that they've seen yet. And we also are lucky in the Treasure Valley by having pretty abundant water supply from all the snowmelt that comes into the Boise River and the Snake River every spring and every summer, melting from the past winter season. So it's not to say that there certainly are climate concerns about what effect droughts and less snowfall and potentially changes in rainfall will have on the area. But I think what water experts told me was that these issues that the wells are having are, you know, more about the changes in irrigation than they are about changes in climatic conditions.
Hmm. You can read that story at idahostatesman.com. Back to election season, municipal elections just over a week away. That includes some bond issues as well. There's a jail expansion bond in Ada County, EMS reconfiguration and funding changes proposed in Valley County, and I guess a shameless plug for coverage on both those issues coming up here next week on Boise State Public Radio. There are plenty of school districts asking for funding November 7th as well. Kevin, Idaho Ed News is always tracking those. What are you watching for about a week from now?
Well, I think we've got several school elections that are really interesting, bond issues and levies. The big ones that I'll be watching for, there's one in Pocatello. Now, you remember Highland High School in Pocatello, pretty serious fire back in the spring. School officials are still trying to figure out how to accommodate students this fall. It's a bit of a work in progress over there. A bond issue to try to repair, renovate, create some space for high school students. Shelley, which is like a really relatively small school district in eastern Idaho, has a $70 million bond issue. That's a lot of money for a district of that size. Closer to home here, the biggest one to watch is in Nampa. It's about a $30 million supplemental levy over the course of 2 years. So it depends on where you live, but in some communities, we're going to see some bonds and levies. And I suspect we'll see more of them in November now, because the legislature in 2023 got rid of the March election date that schools had used pretty extensively for bond issues and levies. You can't run elections in March anymore. You got to run them in either May, August, or November. So I suspect we'll see more of them on the November ballot alongside of, you know, mayor's races, city council races, school board elections. So we'll see what happens on November 7th and whether this is a sign of things to come.
And I think some of the thought there was both saving money by eliminating an election, right, but also trying to get these issues onto ballots that may be more widely voted on, where voter turnout is increased, right?
That has been the rationale for a lot of changes you've seen in election law, in school election law, is to increase turnout. The concern was that a March election date, because it was standalone, there was nothing else on the ballot, no other races of any kind, you had very low turnout. And the suspicion among some legislators is that, well, school districts are just trying to sneak bond issues or levies through when basically nobody's voting and nobody's watching. So turnout is definitely the driving force behind moving these bond and levy elections more into May and November. And it's also the driving force behind why we have school board elections in November now instead of in May.
Ian, we were exchanging text messages here kind of behind the scenes, and you were mentioning, we talked earlier about the Boise mayoral race and some of the issues around policing and the new zoning code that have been brought up. But there are some deeper cultural divides between the two frontrunner candidates, incumbent Lauren McClain and challenger Mike Masterson as well. And you wanted to talk a little bit more about those.
Yeah, thanks. I figured it'd be good to mention, in addition to those other issues, while local elections, as we've mentioned, aren't partisan in Idaho, Boise State political science professor told me that he thinks there's a ideological tone to this mayor's race. And I think part of that is because social issues have become pretty prominent. And what I mean by that is that Mayor Lauren McClain, who's a Democrat, has been very vocal over the last 4 years about her support for gay and trans rights and support for Boise Pride, and also her support for abortion rights. And that's something that she's been running on in her campaign for a second term. She's included it in her political campaign. She's talked about wanting to be a welcoming city for all kinds of people. And the city council and the mayor also supported a couple of years ago a resolution. This was after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court precedent that guaranteed some abortion rights. Following that, when the state of Idaho passed a number of stringent abortion laws, the city council in Boise passed a resolution basically saying that the city and the police would not prioritize investigations into related to those stringent abortion laws that the state passed. And in the mayor's race, as I said, McClain has been running on these issues, and Masterson, her main opponent, has been, I would say, reluctant to stake a position on the abortion issue in particular. He said that he doesn't think women are safe when politics gets involved in medicine. He said that he's it's not an issue that mayors are responsible for. It's really a question that is before the state legislature and those kinds of policymakers, and that therefore it's not really the mayor's place to get involved in issues like that. And sort of similarly on gay and trans issues, he said he's a proponent of gay rights when he was police chief. He spoke before the legislature about adding language guaranteeing gay rights in the Idaho Constitution. But he's also done that, he quote, quietly, and he's sort of not been campaigning on that issue. So I think that's a interesting distinction between the two candidates as voters look at the different issues that they have taken positions on.
Well, and some of that divisiveness is not coming from the candidates themselves. Masterson has had to disavow work done in his name by outside political action committees and some of his campaign supporters in recent days.
Yeah, that's also true. In one instance, he returned a donation from actually a previous candidate for a College of Western Idaho trustee position who had made some anti-gay posts online. Masterson returned a campaign donation from that candidate saying he doesn't support that. And he also condemned an advertisement that a political action committee made on his behalf. These are organizations that operate to benefit candidates, but they operate independently from campaigns. And the political action committee had condemned Mayor McLean's quote, far left agenda by referring to her support for gay pride. And Masterson came out and disavowed that support too. So it's definitely kind of become a prominent issue of interest for residents and voters in this campaign. Mm.
Of course, campaign finance, no stranger to larger races like mayoral competitions or city council. But Kevin, you reported this week, there's a lot of money flowing to certain school district or school board races as well. Why is that so surprising?
It's surprising because we just have not seen this before. And I should emphasize that a lot of school board elections around the state are still pretty low key. They're pretty low budget. A lot of uncontested races around the state. A lot of districts really have to scramble to find people to serve as trustees. I mean, it's a thankless job. Mm-hmm. It's an unpaid position. You get a lot of grief from constituents over anything from, you know, the school schedule, when vacation falls, when summer begins and ends. Now, you have to deal with student discipline issues. You hire or fire, in some cases, a school superintendent. You know, there's all of this, you know, aftershock from the pandemic and culture wars that are permeating school board politics. So a lot of people just don't really want the job. But in some cases, you've got folks who really want the job. I'm watching very closely an election in West Ada, where you have a candidate, Tom Moore. He's a retiree. He moved to Meridian about 9 years ago. He has loaned himself $50,000 to run for school board. I can't tell you that's an all-time record, but it is nothing I've seen in the past few years watching school board elections around the state. And it's forced the incumbent in that race, Renee Ozuna. She's raised so far about $10,000. She's gotten some money from some folks in the development community. Meridian Mayor Robert Simison gave Ozuna a donation. $10,000 would normally be quite a lot of money in a school board election. Well, you know, 10,000 is not 50,000. And Moore does not tell me for sure how he plans to spend that 50,000 or if he plans to spend all 50,000. But the price of admission in that particular school board election has definitely gone up. And, you know, I wrote a story earlier this week kind of tracking what's happening with campaign finance in school board races in West Ada, CUNA, and Caldwell, because I thought those were three interesting school districts and maybe symptomatic of what we're seeing in school board politics now.
And perhaps not uncoincidentally, three of the fastest growing areas in the state of Idaho and fastest growing school districts as well.
Right. You've got that whole tension between growth and accommodating students and, you know, concerns about how to pay for facilities. all of that bubbling to the surface on top of all the other issues that schools are facing.
Yeah. In our last few minutes, Kevin, real quickly, a change in superintendent now official in the West Bonner School District, where Brandon Durst, the controversial choice there, who issued a resignation in September, but left it up to the board to make that date. That is now official, correct?
Right. The board finally did make a change in the superintendency on Wednesday. This has been such a never-ending story up there the past few months. And it's really, you know, like we were talking about before, about the role of school trustees. You know, the trustees voted in a divided vote back in June, I believe it was, to hire Durst. Well, two of the three trustees who made that vote to hire Durst, they were recalled in an election in August. Now the remaining three trustees are going to be on the ballot on November 7th. Mm-hmm. So when I think about school board races that I'm watching closely, in addition to the ones we just talked about, West Ada, CUNA, Caldwell, West Bonner is definitely one we'll be watching closely.
Kevin, thank you for your work and for joining us today. We've been speaking with Kevin Richard, who is the senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. Also joining us on the Reporter Roundtable today, Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman and Kyle Fonensteel, reporter for the Idaho Capital Sun. Thank you all for being here and have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.